Hi, my name's Radcliffe, I'm an addict.
Hi, Radcliffe.
And that's quite surreal. The reason we do this is to help each other stay clean, and I never forget, that's why I come to meetings. And thanks very much, Lucinda, for sharing, and Andrew, for chairing this meeting. My battle with addiction continues, which is why I still come to meetings a few years down the line. And when I first came into Narcotics Anonymous, I remember being vastly underwhelmed by what I saw, to be honest. And I thought, get real. And I really struggled. My journey and my story really involves, I think, the most important message that Narcotics Anonymous has to give anyone, which is just keep coming back. And I kept coming back time and time and time again. And the reason I had to keep coming back time and time again was because I kept going off. And the reason I kept going off was because I had a condition which presupposes me to believe that the use of some form of mood-altering chemical is going to improve my life. It never has. It never did. But I was the last to know that I had a problem. Everybody else apparently could see it a mile off. The fact that I started my journey, and I'm living proof that addiction knows no social boundaries whatsoever, in fact. I started from a fairly comfortable position, down a very long drive with gate lodges, and I ended up just round the corner from here, actually, about 4 minutes walk away, in a skip, in a mews. Not in a very amusing skip. I do tell everyone that it was a convertible skip. It had a rag top. My pride wanting still to have some edge, even in despair and homelessness. But that's where my using journey took me, via a number of crisis intervention points. And where they 12-step treatments, we talk about psychiatry, doesn't help. I was put in my first nut house when I was 19. That was during my first attempt to detox under my own guidance. And it wasn't a great success. I was a little unschooled in the art of detox. This was in the late 70s. I don't think detoxes had been invented, actually, at that point. And I'd gone home. Fatal mistake. Come here. Don't go home. Come here. And I had a heroin habit, my first heroin habit. And when I say my first, I only had one. But it was an attempt to break that one heroin habit. And I did what every free spirit of the age does when he goes home. I lied. I said, oh, a bit run down. I've been working terribly hard. And my mother, bless her, trooper to the last, and took me to the doctor. And I'm just about to speak, and she does what all mums do. You know, it's lovely. Now, doctor, he's a bit run down. We'll need something to pep him up. Well, for those of you who have had a heroin habit, using speed to come off it is not the best way. And so there are two, I don't know about the girls here, and I know it's a mixed audience, but for men, coming off a heroin habit requires two things. Is you need a lot of tissue, for obvious reasons, and you need peace and quiet and solitude. So I was wanking my way through the most horrendous time of my life. It's my experience. You're late. Find him a seat, someone who needs it. And so, I mean, you can imagine, I had this sort of eclectic range of pornography laying all over my bedroom floor. So I could just roll over, groan, look, get inspired, get off, and try and get back to sleep. And that's all I knew to try and do, to be honest. They didn't have leaflets about this sort of shit. And my mother thought, no. What you do? And her view was, she came into my room, you know, after 4 days of no sleep or whatever, I'd finally got to sleep, you know, absolutely red raw. And she walked in and said, "Come on, get up. Ugh, no. And she came back in again 5 minutes later. "Come on, get up. You know, my first line of defence, this moat of pornography, hadn't stopped her. And she came through and she pulled off the duvet cover where the really specialist collection had been hidden. And so she stands there and thinks, "Oh, God, you're so disgusting. Get up. This is no way to live. Get up. And I... the memories never go away. I got up and I was so... The rage, the anger, the shame and just the shitty whatever of this burned out husk of... I was 19 years old and I was spent. And I picked up an electric fire, apparently. My father was standing in the doorway. He said he witnessed it. I picked up an electric fire and I smashed her to the ground with it. Threw it to the side and said, "Now you get up," and walked out. And that was to my own parents. I was 19 years old. And I was either high or I was nothing. I didn't have anything. I had no joy. I had no hope. It was just dark. If you took the drugs out of my system, I felt hideous. I got locked up for that, and I don't think it was unreasonable. But what I learned was really scared me. I learned that if you take the drugs out of my system, I'm not good. It doesn't really work for me. And so I knew I had an addiction problem. I knew I had a drug problem, certainly. But what I didn't know was that I had any other option. I didn't believe that if I could have nothing, I would ever feel okay. And I then defended my right to keep using. And I became incredibly adept at lying and stealing. I had two drivers in life. I wanted to be high, and I wanted not to be found out. So hiding, the lying, the cheating, the ducking, the diving, it all came naturally to me. And over a career of coming in and out of the rooms, out of a career where I tried to work, where I tried to do what I understood to be the civilian thing of life, and you get married and you have children, the only constant was that I used. And so to take that constant away from me left me spiritually bereft and terrified. I believe, and this is a view looking back, that I was kind of just built... If you imagine an electric plug with its blue wire and the brown and the yellow, I was like born without that insulating plastic on the wires. Everything was very jangly. That's what it felt like. I felt raw. The lights were too bright. The noise is too loud. My emotional state was so erratic, obviously erotic during detox moments, but it was so erratic that I was unstable. So for me, managing being Radcliffe in the world, the logical thing to do was to take something. That seemed to me entirely reasonable. And it was only, you know, and I could justify that, and the rationalizations and all the stuff that we all come up with, the bullshit that addicts, while we're at it, can come up with, kept me out there for a very long time. I was really lucky, because at the end of my using time, I was homeless. I was friendless. I had abandoned my wife, I'd abandoned two wives, technically. I've had several wives, two of them were my own. And another area that my addiction found very easy to operate in. And I was a husk. I mean, the way I describe it is I was feral. I was this feral human being. I didn't wash. And I'm ridiculously tall, even now. Although I don't look so tall, because the spiritual girth over the last few years has overtaken me. But I was tall, with this ridiculously posh accent, which, and a lot of people say, God, he's got a lot of advantages, that man. I mean, at the back you can't see, but up close, you know, mid to late 30s, perhaps. Oh, he's tall, he speaks frightfully well. Well, none of that was an advantage at 4 in the morning in Peckham, when I'm trying to squirt crack. I cannot tell you how much time I spent being frisked and searched with my trousers around my ankles, you know. This guy's definitely the old Bill. It's not all easy being me. It didn't stop me going there. Yeah, and my using... I was a car crash addict. I was full on or full off. I never had that sort of, oh, we'll just ease in. You know, I was a... my belief system was, well, if one is good, 10 must be fantastic. And 10 was fantastic. You know, that's sort of what I did. But the preoccupation, if anyone is new and doesn't identify with anything I say, see, for me, when you take the drugs away, or the threat of the drugs away, ask yourself, what am I prepared to do to get loaded? And I remember another intervention, being taken to a doctor, and the doctor saying, if you go on using like that, you'll be dead within 3 months. And I was a needle junkie. And I remember my mum was, you know, this is the same woman who'd seen me do the first detox, so she was nervous. And I'm sitting, you know, I've got a white shirt on, and it's covered in blood. And I, you know, they hadn't invented videos, to be honest, but without video evidence, I didn't do that. No, that's not me. The fact that my shirt had stuck to my blood, that I'm bright yellow, because I've got jaundice, because I've been, you know, injecting whatever, neatly passed me by. And I thought, I can style this out. And this was in the days before treatment centres, actually, to be fair, when parents treated drug addiction with presents and holidays. Not a successful strategy, quite good for the addict at the time. And I remember being given this very, a really fancy watch is what I was given as a birthday present. Now, this is what I did. And I'm, you know, an educated man. I didn't go to a pawn shop and sell it and get the money or anything like that. No. The quickest way that I could get where I needed to be was to stumble around to the man, which I did. I said, hold that, give me some bail. And I went home and started to make up my little hit. And sort of thousands of pounds worth of watch sitting in this guy's flat in Chiswick. And suddenly there's this hideous smell of Sunday lunch everywhere. And this guy sold me a quarter gram bag of lamb seasoning, which I'm now boiling up. My head is going, well, no one's that much of a bastard that it won't have some drugs in it. So I shot it up anyway. I came around 3 days later, having gone into a coma, in the local hospital, with a new nickname, which was Roast Radcliffe. And the really tragic, the addiction part of this is, as soon as I was strong enough to walk, get up, I got up out of that hospital bed, and I went straight back to the same guy, because it was the quickest place I knew to get what I needed, which was to get high. This guy had nearly killed me the day before, 3 days before, whatever. And I'd gone round there. And the other annoying thing about addiction is this guy's holding thousands of pounds worth of my watch. I've nearly died. And I'm selling, you know, I'll get you some fags. What do you need, milk? I'll be round in 5 minutes. You know, I would sell my soul, anyone else's soul. By the time I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I had been broken. The pride had gone. I lived this feral existence. Supporting a drug habit, stealing chicken wings out of Sainsbury's, basically, is what I did. In fact, I like to think I redefined meat trading in the 70s. And my skipmate, Delroy, and I, he had a spiderweb tattoo across half his face. He wasn't easy to miss. And I was 6'4" with my accent. Has anybody seen the chops? You are talking, or listening to, a man that got done for the most well-travelled leg of lamb in Britain. They put a tracking device in it.
In a leg of lamb?
And I got nicked for this leg of lamb. And you might think, well, it serves him right. But, I mean, have some sympathy. Imagine going back into jail. I'd only been released about 4 weeks before. So a lot of the same faces were there. Hello, mate, what are you in for? You kind of want a bit of Brick's mass in the story. Do you know what I mean? A leg of lamb. I mean, the shame. That's what I did. You know, I was a thief, this feral addict. And that's what I'd become. That I didn't have anything else. I'd abandoned my children. I'd abandoned my wife, my family, my friends. They didn't know. I dropped off the map. So when I came into NA the last time, this terrified guy, and I could barely speak. It was, I've never shut up since, but I could barely talk. I found it very easy to get drugs in prison. Not so easy to pay for them. And I'd taken a bit of a beating. When my three items had come up shy. And I took a kicking on the yard, and I'd lost half my teeth. And when I came into recovery, I'd lost my voice and my teeth. I'd lost all the bumptiousness that made me, that I thought my spirit was broken. And I was very blessed, because I walked out of a detox in a pair of stolen shoes, funnily enough, and socks, which didn't match, into the beginners' meeting in Park Walk. And the guy doing the chair, he's here tonight, actually, he's in this room. A lot of you will know him, Gary. We've been arguing this ever since. What I heard him say, which apparently he didn't, but what I heard him say was that the decision as to whether or not he used again was in his feet, not in his head. And I heard him. And I sort of looked at my feet in stolen shoes, has to be said. But I understood what he meant. And for me, and if anyone's new, recovery is not it's not something you can read and get, or for me it wasn't. It's not something you can think and get. It's not something you can feel and get. For me, recovery is something you do, and you take actions. And for some reason, the recovery comes after the action. And we all, you know, Lucinda spoke very clearly about being able to recite in rehab, recite the 12 steps. I could have probably done that at one point. Like you, I don't think I could today. But all of that knowledge has no value without action. That's what I've learned. That's what the example that you guys and other guys that have been before us have given me is their example, is the net result of their actions, is they're able to live lives that don't require them to smash themselves to bits on a daily basis. And at the end of the day, isn't that what we're all here for? Is how to do that. I could stop. I could stop. I went into treatment 21 times. Not proud of that fact, but it is a fact. And I stopped every time I went in there. My problem was that I always started again. How on earth was I going to stay stopped? What defence was I going to have against the mental obsession when it was on me? And the only defence that has ever worked for this addict is to keep attending Narcotics Anonymous. I keep being available, I hope, to do service. I keep in touch with other addicts that are in recovery. And I keep in touch with addicts who aren't in recovery. Because I actually believe that what we do here matters not just for us. It matters not just for your friends and your immediate family. Although the ripple effect of what goes on here is so powerful to everybody else. But what I think we do here is we keep the light on for the next using addict that says, do you know what, I'm done with this. And you guys kept the light on for me in those 21 times that I came in and took the piss and walked out again. Nobody came up to me and said, you can't come. Nobody. Not one person. All I ever got was a welcome. And if you want to have what I have, just do this. And it's the most perfectly formed spiritual exercise. Because all we have to do is the lazy man's way to happiness. We just follow the steps, we listen to other people, we do what somebody else has done. We don't have to break any new ground at all. It's fantastic. And that's what I got from that guy's chair. What was I prepared to do? And what I did, and we share our experience, what I did was I went back to another meeting. And then I went to another meeting. And I remember on the third meeting, this guy came up to me and he said, you need to get some fucking teeth. And he was right, of course. And I had this sort of, you know, I was this very broken guy. Where's the love? Oh. But he did what we do. He was really practical. He took me to his dentist. He helped me with some practical, you know, one, he pointed out the problem, and two, he then offered me a solution. And oh boy, I went to the dentist and we started having the rebuild, and I became insufferable. Because I would go to a meeting every day at this point, and everybody got both barrels day in, day out, as I had my mouth reconstructed. And I kept showing about the bridge to normal living being replaced. And then I got these new teeth. Hi. Suddenly life was going to be okay. And I got these new teeth, and I could smile, and I could, you know, I could sit with girls and not have to eat soup and things like that. I could take solids at last. But the simple physical repair for me happened very quickly. And I think it happens for a lot of us, not for everyone, but it happened very quickly. And physically I started to get well and feel okay. And within 6 to 9 months to a year, I was feeling quite physically restored. What that hides, though, very often, and it was for me, was the emptiness within, the sense of overwhelmingness that life still had. And I stuck very close. I came to lots of meetings, and I talked loads, and most of it was just my inner Tourette's at the drop of a hat. And it doesn't matter what I said. It really doesn't matter. And some of it was good, and some of it was probably not good, and some of it was nonsense, and it doesn't really matter. What I did was I turned up and I opened my mouth and I let other human beings get to know me. You know, the good stuff and the bad stuff. And that's kind of what happened. And I was accepted. And because I could see that I was accepted by you, you guys gave me permission to accept myself. And the more I was able to accept myself, the more I was able to stand up and be counted as a man. And I remember by the time I was coming, just before I started my step four, there was this big thing that I'd abandoned my children. I've got three fabulous children. And I would have sat there for hours, stoned off my face, telling you how much I loved them. Probably spending and smoking the birthday present that I was meant to be giving to one of them an hour later at the party I didn't turn up to. That's the kind of dad I'd become. And it was time to re-engage. And I was very scared about it. And I remember going around and knocking on my children's front door. And it was my middle son's birthday. And he opened the door. And he spat in my face. And he said, why don't you F off, you junkie scumbag, C-U-N-T. I felt it. I can't do this. I just couldn't do it. I completely everything was for nothing. I mean, you know, it was just felt like the ultimate rejection. Very self-centered, I know. But I did have a desire to re-engage with them. And I walked across Clapham Common, and I walked into my sponsors, I fell into my sponsor's arms, actually, and wept. Pity. I felt so sorry and sad. And I thought, I've left it too late. I've gone down too far. I can't come back from this. And I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And he was very cool. He said, well, now you're here, you better have supper. He said, so much of recovery is we do the next thing. We do what's next on the agenda. We have a cup of tea or we go to work. And he immediately brought me out of this sort of Byron-esque, tragic, bleak, you know. And he said, look, and he said, why wouldn't he be pissed off? And, you know, I thought, yeah, why wouldn't he be? Anyway, the programme gave me an opportunity to empathise with other people and to see the world, or see me in the world from someone else's perspective, which was probably not very good. And I did a fourth step, inventory. And I remember saying, because a lot of people talk about the fourth step and sorts the men from the boys, and it's just one of the gifts that we have. It's an opportunity to go, this is who you are. That's all it does. And I remember, and I was avoiding writing it as usual, and I rang up my sponsor and I said, oh God, oh, every time I sit down to do it, I feel like shit. And he said, of course you do. He said, you already feel like shit. All this is going to do is show you why. And then we can work out how to stop that. And I could buy that, and it was great. And so I did it, and I went through that process, and I arranged with him to do my fifth step. I shared a fifth step with my God and myself and another human being. And I was terrified, because there was quite a lot of stuff that was shaming to me. May not be to other people. There's a section in the fourth and fifth step which deals with our sexual inventory. Well, you've heard about my detoxing. My sexual inventory was quite eclectic. It had been quite varied and several. And not particularly gender-specific at various times in my life. And I was very embarrassed and shy about sharing this stuff with another human being, to be honest. And he'd done what he normally does, is he'd asked me around to do this for a step and said, we'll eat while we talk. And he cooked bangers and mash. So I sat revealing my inner dark of those secrets while my sponsor sat sucking a sausage on the floor. wasn't quite how I'd imagined it going. What it all did was make me feel okay with myself. And then he did something really remarkable. Is he suggested I did another fourth step just on my time in recovery. And I'd come in quite late. I was 43 or something. So I had quite a long life of out there on the road doing what we do. And he did something really cool. He said, I want you to do a fourth step just on your time in recovery. Now what that did was where the real work for me started, because it showed me who I was without the justification and that motivation and that feeling to go and get, you know, stuff. I mean, my sense of entitlement is very well developed, I might say. You know, I could steal from anyone at the drop of a hat and feel okay about it. But I didn't feel okay about it, to be honest. But I couldn't stop myself from doing it, so I learned to live with it because it was expedient. But in recovery, if I wasn't in the pursuit of more drugs, then what was I about? Who was this guy, Radcliffe? I mean, apart from these great teeth, who was this guy? You know? And I found out. And I found out in the most loving, all sort of embracing way that I could, warts and all, through the fourth and fifth process. And I did another fifth step with him. And it was kind of cool. And then I went into the sixth and seventh process. And while I'm busy focusing on doing all that and going to meetings, I suddenly realise, you know, I'm a year or 2 years clean, and I'm 3 years, and then it builds up. And I keep coming. And the more I've kept coming, the more it's built up. And then, you know, we don't get an immunity from life. What we get is an opportunity to live it without getting smashed, which is great. But life has come at me a bit in the last... Well, the last year has had its challenges. A little under a year ago, I had a stroke. which was terrifying. And my girlfriend at the time walked in to the bedroom. I'd collapsed, and I had a blood clot in my brain. And I knew something wasn't right. And I did that very English thing, just ignore it, it'll go away, I'll sleep it off. And luckily it passed very quickly. And then I went into denial, as we do, nothing wrong with me. And I went to the back man and said, oh, I think I've got a bit of a pinched nerve in my neck, would you sort it out? I described what had happened, and he sort of froze, freaked out. Okay. I said, I want you to put your shirt on now. There's a telephone in my office, and I want you to call your doctor. And 40 minutes later, I'm being fast-tracked through St. Mary's Paddington, you know, head of the queue. That felt rather special, actually. But only as it should be, of course. sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I had to face, in a way that I'd never done through the using and, you know, the overdoses and, you know, the sort of, you know, I've had half my lungs removed, burnt out on a crack pipe. So I'm quite used to crisis intervention, you know, from physically doing myself in. But this came out of the blue. It wasn't of my own volition, and it terrified me. It absolutely terrified me. And I was put in touch with my own mortality in a way that my using, bizarrely, never did. How do you reconcile that? I don't know, maybe it's the addiction thing. And since then, it's given me the courage to do things that I'd never dared do before, which was to say, I don't want to be this businessman trying to do stuff that I don't really believe in, just going through the motions. I want to do something that makes me feel alive, that makes me feel that whatever happens in life, I gave it a go. And I now do other things. I gave up my job. I've been looked after so far. I quit my job formally. And unfortunately, my girlfriend quit me on an iPad via email. And of course, the fact that I'd bought the iPad really bad. Choose wisely, people. That hurt. And I've learned that, you know, relationships come and go in my life. And I hurt. But you know what I heal to? I heal. And that's what Narcotics Anonymous has done for me, is it's given me that opportunity to heal with other people, drawing on their strength and support when I don't have it for myself, which is often. I've been given a huge opportunity when a phone call came about last summer, and my very beautiful son, who I love along with all my other children, rang me up. And I suddenly found myself with the exquisite privilege of handling a 12-step call from my own child, from a child that 7 years ago had rejected me, was now reaching out to this recovering addict in the belief and the hope that I had some solutions for him. We may not. My job is to carry that message, which I have done. And as a dad, bait him out and get him out of trouble. But how? Repeatedly. Which is, of course, the other problem. Is they're living the high life, and I'm fucking paying for it. How does that work? I love them. I love you guys. There are great friends of mine. There are people who I really respect, and some I don't know so well, and there are people that have been sort of side by side on this journey with me. What I know is that for me, the steps have become the sat-nav to the soul. If I follow the steps to the best of my ability, which varies in different times, then I'm pretty much moving towards the next clean day. And I have a process through the 10th inventory process where I can start to check where I'm being a bit off key. And I'm much quicker at doing it I've become much more adept at skirting around addiction. Because for me, without drugs, what is Radcliffe's addiction today? And it's something about the way I think. It lives in my thinking. And I have to challenge that with my behaviour. I continue to walk my way into recovery, to act my way into it. Because if somebody asked me the other day, well, what, you don't take drugs anymore. What is addiction? And I said, if somebody says to me, hey, Rad, I really like your jacket, what I hear is, I don't like your trousers. That's the condition I live in. It's been a real privilege to come and talk to you, and I want to just thank you all. You guys gave my kids their dad back. For that, I love you. Thank you.